Now a local author. His name is David Nabhan, and we're going to be talking about his most recent book, and we're going to be talking about a bit of debate as well within the science fiction writers community. First of all, let me welcome you, David Nabhan, to our program. Nice to chat with you.
Dave, I appreciate very much a chance to have a few words with your listeners. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, sure, sure. I will mention straight away that David is going to be speaking tomorrow, at the Barnes & Noble bookstore in Cranberry. I think most folks around here know where that is. And when will you be there tomorrow, David?
Let's see. I'm going to be there from 2 to 4, and if science fiction is not your cup of tea, another local writer, an acclaimed children's writer, Melanie Atmore, author of From a Butterfly's Eye, she'll also be there, too, with me.
Well, I'm anxious to discuss this bit of a firestorm within the science fiction authors community, and we'll do that. But first of all, let me talk about your latest book, The Pilots of Borealis. What's this all about? Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of the plot?
Well, probably the best recommendation is that it was released only a month and a half ago, and at this moment, the executive vice president of one of Hollywood's foremost studios is reading it as we speak, so within weeks we should get an idea whether it's going to be optioned as a future feature film. So I can assure your listeners they've never read a book like it. The characters in the genre of literature also that they'll meet in the book are unlike any they've seen before. The protagonist, especially Clinton Ritner, he's destined for the silver screen if anyone is. The book revolves around him. He's an extremely multidimensional character, the world's foremost ex-mercenary in the 25th century, a very, very dangerous man, someone who's shed more blood than Tamerlane. Someone who's seen everything, but much of it the stuff that anyone would very much want to turn away from. But believe it or not, in the end, the reader will be rooting for him with everything they've got. It's a powerful story like that. Very gray, not black and white in any way, shape, or form. The story treats an energy crisis of the far future, how the three most powerful and stunningly interesting cultures that hold sway in the solar system 500 years from now would deal with it. Not of petroleum, though, of helium-3 on the... and helium-3 exists. It's on the surface of the moon. It's one of the few places you can find the stuff. But it's a story about superlative and conflicted individuals that are thrust into some really terrifying crucibles that could exist only in the far future. And the thing is, though, it's a very adult, hair-raising book, but one that you could give to your children, absolutely, to read. This is nonstop, pulse-pounding, kind of a do-or-die thrill ride, yet absent any of the brow-beating messages that hopefully you're going to ask me about, these messages, the political messages and that kind of stuff. That's you won't find that in my book. And without a single vulgarity, I'm kind of proud of that, or any set-piece, hackneyed sex scene. So it was written for the smart reader. It's a thriller, suspense, mystery romance, just set 500 years into the future, very much in the style of Blade Runner. And the last thing I'll say, the critics are comparing it to the classic sci-fi of Asimov, Heinlein, and Clarke, and I'm simply thrilled and humbled to have my name uttered in the same sentence with those giants.
Well, that's for sure, Asimov and Clarke. I'm not a voracious reader of science fiction. I'm certainly not knocking the genre, believe me. It's just an area that I don't read a lot, and maybe I will in the future, who knows. But I know those names that you just mentioned. That's
great names.
Let's talk a little bit about you, David Nabhan. I know you live in Pittsburgh now. Are you a native of this area, or have you moved here? What's the deal on that?
Well, your audience may not... I'm new now, but I'm not going anywhere. Your audience may not be familiar with my name, but if we were speaking on the West Coast, that would definitely not be the case. Without pounding my chest... I've been interviewed or had articles written about me on many, many hundreds of occasions all around the world in the most prestigious media fonts in existence, not due to my science fiction, but due to three prior science works that I've published regarding earthquakes and seismic forecasting on the West Coast. So I'm a science writer, an op-ed and magazine writer, an author of peer-reviewed papers in seismology, and a science fiction author, too. And I guess the last note about me, I'm a retired teacher from, spent two decades in South Central Los Angeles for the Los Angeles Unified School District and was the earthquake preparedness coordinator there. And, you know, that's part of how I part of the background for the earthquake stuff. Mm-hmm.
Well, I was looking over some of the places where either you or your work has been featured: CBS News, Popular Science, Inside Edition, Howard Stern, London Daily Mail, Drudge Report, and on and on and on. So,
yeah people are interested in earthquakes, and on the West Coast especially. But let me say this about Pittsburgh. I was stunned when I got here. What a beautiful city. The people are absolutely fantastic, and gorgeous town, and I wouldn't rather be any other place right now. I love the place.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this controversy, and I will confess to you, David, that I until I came in contact with you, I was not familiar with it. In fact, I was not familiar with the Hugo Awards. Let's start there, because that's central to the current debate. The Hugo Awards are, this is like the Oscars of science fiction writing, or
exactly.
Okay.
And don't feel bad. You're not the only one. I'm stunned. You know, there's a worldwide dust up going on about it, but you're certainly not the only one who's you know, in the dark about this. And let me try to give your listeners the, I won't, you know, go drone on and on, but I'll try to get the Cliff Note version for them.
Mm-hmm.
Something obviously is happening in science fiction and at the Hugo Awards. In the entire history, and you're right, the Hugos is like the Emmys or the Oscars. It's an incredibly prestigious award. Ray Bradbury and all the guys we just talked about before, they all were, you know, connected with the Hugos. In the entire history of the awards, though, prior to this year, there have been 5 instances in total when no award was given in a category. And the last time that happened was in 1977, you know, once. In 2015, the awards, just a few weeks ago in Spokane, there were 5 categories equaling all the previous rejections in which no award was the final verdict. So that obviously, you know, tells you that something is happening. And there have been complaints over the last few years that from some writers that just as our schools and colleges, media, and other venues in the public forum have been in the crosshairs of a progressive left whose agenda is to change the country, that science fiction has also now been made to bow down to certain political incentives. Good writing isn't the overarching hallmark as much as an agenda to be celebrated, whether it makes sense for the story or not. That's their objection. Instead of superlative fiction worked by individuals into masterpieces by no one but the artists themselves alone, a formulaic recipe is demanded in order to win critical acclaim. A certain number of diverse characters from 100 different special interest groups. I'm sure you and your listeners have heard this litany. You know, a strong female protagonist instead of a male one. A message that paints religion, patriotism, and conservative views as stupid and mind-numbing. It's a platform that pays homage to free health care and free everything and open borders and all, you know, the scourge of inequality that from Western values and all the rest. In short, these heavy-handed message books have dominated the scene in science fiction. And in the last few years, finally, there's been a backlash. A more traditional group known as the Sad Puppies has seen fit to use some strong-arm tactics of their own, and it's turned the Hugo Awards into a cultural battleground. As I said, a few weeks ago, the rancor between both sides was apparent. No award conferred in, I think it was Best Novella, Best Short Story, Best Related Work, Best Editor, all left vacant, which is, you know, historically shocking. Yet the crowd cheered enthusiastically each time it happened, even as the presenters squirmed uncomfortably in front of the cameras. Just really bizarre. Imagine if that happened at the Oscars or the Emmys. It's, in my view, shameful in the extreme, and a terrible indication of just how rabid and compromising our political forum has become.
Well, you mentioned the Oscars, and it occurs to me, I mean, there's not been any firestorm about this, but it has been mentioned in two or three of the last several years. Are there women directors who have been nominated, you know, for mm-hmm. best director? Is there a representative number of people of color in a particular category or so on and so forth. I'm sure you're aware of that. I mean, I wouldn't call it a firestorm, but it's been mentioned in the media.
Well, look, yeah, you're right. This is just a reflection of what's happening everywhere. Day before yesterday, they removed the Ten Commandments from the Oklahoma State House. Only yesterday in Missouri, there were protesters demanding to pull down all of Thomas Jefferson's statues and monuments. People are actually digging up Civil War generals who have lain in graves for 150 years and dumping the bodies elsewhere. There's no doubt that there is a segment of our population who are bound and determined to either change or erase the icons of American culture. So one has every right to ask if the traditionalist sad puppies, you know, have any base for their complaints. It's painfully apparent that the powers that be are quite interested in editing our reading material. Look, as I said, I was a teacher for two decades in South Central Los Angeles. Look at our textbooks. I taught in South Central L.A. for 20 years. You want to know what Columbus Day is called in California history books? It's not Columbus Day anymore. It's Dia de la Raza, the Day of the Race. So I'll leave it to your listeners to ask themselves what's going on. Go to the movies. Look at the movies that they, or your listeners go to movies, they read, they see what our society is saying to them on television, in the cinema, on billboards, in magazines. And back to science fiction, let's just take a look at the big mega hit in science fiction over the last few years, Elysium, with Matt Damon. Did you see it?
I did not, no.
Okay, well, anyone with a functioning brain could tell immediately that was not science fiction. That was a political political propaganda, and not even adroitly camouflaged propaganda. It might have taken place in the future, you know, but that doesn't make it sci-fi. It was an unvarnished advertisement for free health care and open borders, released just during the same period that the Obamacare debate was at fever pitch. And you know, the story was about haves versus have-nots, the evils of wealth inequality, and, of course, the evil empire, always portrayed as elite, Western, rich, pampered, conservative. I have no doubts, nor do I think any thinking person would, that there's a very dangerous and pernicious attempt being made by, you know, to get a stranglehold on every media font in our nation. And so on the other side, I'm not sure what the sad puppies are doing is the proper way to go, but at least they're bringing the matter to the public forum. There's probably room for blame on both sides. But honestly, though, I think most Americans realize which side of the spectrum has chosen silencing their opponents as a weapon of choice. It isn't conservatives who are yanking Bernie Sanders' microphone away from him and preventing him from giving speeches at his own rallies, or throwing pies in Ann Coulter's face, and or shouting down and running out speakers at college campuses. When one of the greatest liberal leaders of the day, who I admire, Kirsten Powers, is herself so disgusted at the brown shirt tactics of her own party that she writes the current best-selling book, How the Left is Killing Free Speech, it's pretty obvious who the great offenders are. So I won't mince words here. I agree with Ms. Powers. The progressive left is either going to have to change its name or change its ways, because there's really nothing progressive about stormtrooper tactics.
Who, and I mentioned earlier that I'm not familiar with the Hugo Awards. I know, just for the sake of comparison, that the Academy Awards, the Oscars, are voted upon by members of the Academy. Actors vote for actors, directors vote for directors, and so on and so forth. Who votes for the Hugo Awards?
You're on the right track. It's something like that. It's really, there's some really arcane, I'm going to give the short version. There's some really arcane tactics that both sides are using. I'm on no one's memo, so I'm on either side. You know, no one gives me any heads up, but I've got a basic idea. The sad puppies, the conservative traditional group, their tactics are to canvass support and try to vote as a block. You're right, the WorldCom members are the ones who vote. There's, I think, 12,000 of them, and a record 6,000, I think, voted in this last dust-up. So what they're doing is they're prior to voting, they're picking a slate of good contenders that they think, and they're book-bombing the title, trying everything and anything to get their contenders, the ones that they think they have a good chance on, in front of critics, in front of reviewers, in the media, in the public. And the idea is to focus on certain slates where they can dominate and ensure that all the selections for a certain award are of their traditional stripe, to husband their votes and resources in such a way as to assure to push through at least some of their preferences, which is, you know, that's really not, you know, that's underhanded, you know, that's really not the way this should work. So faced with that, the 6,000 Worldcon members who voted refused to have their hands forced and opted for the, you know, the atomic answer, no award, rather than to choose from a block of slate votes that had been placed before them in a way that they thought was inappropriate. And, you know, actually it is inappropriate. Each an author and the work should be judged on its merits. So that's why I say there's blame on both sides. But so that's where it all lays now, and both sides are girding for another showdown next year. But lost in all of this, of course, is the poor reader and how this affects literature in the U.S. I mean, one has to ask what sort of virus has infected our society, such as, you know, the Hugos, the platform that gave the world Ray Bradbury, Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, Robert Heinlein, has been turned into just another bone of contention in the culture wars. It's you know, as I say, there's blame on both sides. But any American who picks up a paperback after hearing this should have reason to wonder what caused it to be published, why and how it was either reviewed well or poorly, what the awards heaped on it or refused it actually mean. It's certainly the antithesis of what we see under the lion at the movie, you know, Ars Gratia Artis, art for the sake of art. That noble sentiment, along with many other attitudes in our nation at present, seems to have gone out the door.
Well, it's a fascinating thing that I, as I mentioned to you earlier, I had no knowledge of, and that's one reason when I heard about your being making an appearance at Barnes & Noble at Cranberry tomorrow, I said, well, let's talk to Dave and see what he has to say. And by the way, will you be signing copies of your book tomorrow?
Oh, yes, I will. And I hope to, I'd like to invite everyone from Butler and Cranberry and the surrounding area to show up. Like, as I said, if you're a sci-fi fan, I'll be more than happy to talk about Helium-3 and, you know, the future of fusion reactors and what the Chinese may be. You know, the Chinese are on their way to the moon just for that very reason. They're not interested in planting their flag on the moon. They're pretty pragmatic people. They're looking toward the Helium-3 that might be powering fusion reactors in the near future. And if again, as I mentioned, if you're not into science fiction, Melanie Atmore, an acclaimed author of children's books from a butterfly's eye, she'll also be there. So, and it's free, it's family friendly, it's good entertainment, and it supports one of the great cultural and literary and educational icons in the area, Barnes and Noble. It's great that big towns and or small towns, having book signings, it's something that the area should be proud of, and it's something that I hope citizens would want to support.
We don't have too many bookstores anymore. That's sad yeah, commentary on our...
Absolutely. Independent bookstores, especially, just so few of them. I did one Mystery Lovers book shop in Oakmont. They're still, it was last week, and it was a great signing and great people, and it's sad that the independent has gone the way of the of so many.
David Nabhan, he's a former educator, a science writer, and a science fiction writer as well. Lives in Pittsburgh now, and he's going to be appearing at Barnes & Noble in Cranberry Square tomorrow afternoon. Nice to talk with you, David. Thanks for being with us today.
Dave, thank you. It's been a privilege and a pleasure to share this message with you, and I want to offer my sincere thanks for a few moments of your valued airtime. I hope to see everyone out there.
Are you looking for a safe, clean...